Welcome everybody to the Pali class once more. Thank you.
Just another class, alright?
Yeah, whatever. Pedants. I haven't taught you, been teaching you Pali all these years, just so you can be pedants. Anyway, okay, Sutta class. Okay, let's start again, shall we? Welcome everybody to the Sutta class for today. And the sutta is the Majjhima 69, the Gulissani Sutta. Okay, Gulissani Sutta has a parallel in the Majjhima Agama. And the Majjhima Agama is? Sarvastivada, Chinese translation, translated by? Translated by Gautama Sanghadeva, I believe. If I'm not completely mistaken. A Sri Lankan person? No.
Asian monk, maybe?
Gautama Sanghadeva, I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but I believe he was probably from Kashmir. Or something like that. Yeah. Usually when they would do the translations of the Agamas, typically they would, and the other translations into Chinese, they would typically have like one, they would have someone who's listed as a translator, but the actual translator, you know, was not the person who did all the work. Okay, and this was kind of fairly typical, as I understand, of things in Europe as well. That if, for example, you might have like an artwork by, you know, Michelangelo or Da Vinci, and it's not the case that he sort of did everything in that artwork by himself, but that they may have had a school and students and so on assisting, and then he would have been overseeing the process. So a similar kind of thing here. There would have been primarily an Indian, or someone fluent in the Indic languages, so someone from Kashmir, Central Asian area, and so on, and together with a Chinese person, and then they
scribes,
and then scribes and assistants and various kinds of things like that. Yeah. Class of sutras. It's not really a class of sutras, it's more like collections of sutras of the early Buddhist schools which are preserved in the Chinese Mahayana tradition, not particularly accurate, but anyway, many of the Agama sutras belong to the Sarvastivadin canon, which is quite true. These sutras correspond to the first four Nikayas of the Sutta Pitaka of the Pali canon, which are also occasionally called Agamas. So it's also worth remembering that the earlier term is Agama. The term we use in Pali, Nikaya, is actually a later terminology. And the Pali commentaries actually quite regularly refer to them as the Agamas as well. Full of Nikayas, which are also occasionally, it's got Agama synonyms for one of the meanings of Nikaya. Okay, four collections of Agamas appear in the East Asian Mahayana canon. It's kind of, there's not really any Mahayana canon as such, but.
What would be the Encyclopedia of Buddhism?
The Encyclopedia of Buddhism is a project which was started many years ago, about I think in the 60s, by a fellow called Dhirasekara, who's now since then has ordained. He's now Professor Dhammavihari, and it was his kind of baby, that project, and it's been going on for years. They haven't come anywhere near completion. But some of the stuff in there is really good, actually. Yeah. So they've only done certain volumes; they haven't done the whole set, as far as I know. I'm not sure how actively they're pursuing it.
So it's like any encyclopedia, that's dictionary and reading.
Something like that, yeah. Okay. So anyway, translated by a fellow called Gautama Sanghadeva in. When? Next question?
AD?
100 AD. God, this is worse than Gali's attempt at getting the temperature from the all of the Agamas were translated within about a generation. So all of the four Agama translations and the main Vinayas were all translated within about a generation, which was about 400 to 430 or something like that, AD. Okay. There were individual sutras translated earlier and things like that, but the main collections were all translated within that span of time, which is quite interesting actually. So obviously there must have been some kind of interest in China in that period. The only major exception to that is the Mula Sarasivadin Vinaya, which was translated in the 7th century.
Same time as Buddha
Ghosts, the same time as Vasubandhu and Asanga. Yeah, so.
The
4th century. That's right, yeah. Translated from? That's good. No, I like that. We started out with Pali, and then we started with the kind of the wobbly bits around the outside, yeah, and getting more and more kind of wibbly wobbly, and that's good. Wibbly wobbly is good, yeah.
Sanskrit?
This one probably was from. It's almost impossible to tell what the original language is, because once it's translated into Chinese, it's very difficult to discern the actual dialect. Yeah, but you can sometimes try to tell the dialect. For example, you can look at the names, like the way that they've transliterated the names from Pali or from the Indic language into Chinese, so you can try to guess what it would have pronounced like in the Indic language. But there's all kinds of complications with doing that. One is that sometimes sometimes they're not necessarily translating literally what was in that text, but they might be translating the name as it was commonly used, right? So there might be a standard rendering of a word like Sariputta or something like that, and so they just translate it as Sariputta, and it doesn't actually represent the pronunciation in that particular dialect. It might just be a generally accepted way of translating it. Or another complication is that the only reason we know how ancient Chinese was pronounced, the main way we know that, is by comparing it with Indic texts. Right? Because we know how the Indic texts were pronounced, and so we guess from that. So for example, like the Buddha today is pronounced four in Mandarin, but they infer that it was pronounced something like Bud in the ancient days. And so by comparing the different Chinese dialects and inferring from the Indian, then they try to guess what the actual Chinese used to sound like. So it's very difficult to work out exactly what it sounded like. So our main evidence, in fact, is this one is from Sarvastivadin school, and all of the scriptures we have of the Sarvastivadin school are written in Sanskrit, or basically classical Sanskrit, or something close to it. Okay, so it seems pretty safe bet that the Sarvastivadins pretty much standardized their texts into Sanskrit, okay, at around the same time that the Theravadins standardized their texts into Pali.
There's no existing Sanskrit texts as such?
There's plenty, there's stacks, yeah, from the Sarvastivadins, all of these things where are we going? And the Sarvastivadins and all kinds of things. Let me just pull up a couple. See what we've got here. And all of that stuff is in Sanskrit. Yeah, all of the Sarvastivadin stuff is in Sanskrit.
And what's the script called?
I don't know too much about scripts, but the scripts are either a variant or related to Ashokan Brahmi, or they're related to the Kharoshthi in the Gandhara area. So yeah, there's basically two systems. I mean, there's variations within that, but basically two kinds of script which are used. Yeah. And of course, the reason
this is just archaeological evidence rather than working text.
This is archaeological. This is no. This is manuscripts. This is basically from manuscripts which are pulled up. No, it's time. Pulled up in here. So there are a few different sources of the Sanskrit texts. One source is the main source, and the most important one is manuscripts, which have been dug up from mainly Afghanistan and places like that. And so they've been dug up and then laboriously reconstructed, okay, by various scholars. That's one source. Another source is a few manuscripts which have been found in Tibetan and Nepalese monasteries, and they include the Lakutarada Bhikshuni Vinaya. And so most of those were actually taken from India to Nepal or Tibet around the time of the ending of Buddhism in India, so around the 11th century, and they've actually been preserved in the monastery, just basically sitting there unread for nearly 1,000 years. And the third source, which is a much less important one, but kind of culturally interesting, is there's a few which have been translated into Sanskrit from Chinese and Tibetan. So I think Lamott did some, maybe Waldschmidt did some. So there's a few suttas which have actually been translated into things. So this is an example of the Sanskrit texts. Most of these are all. So this is a Vinaya text of the Mahasanghikas. These are Mahayana sutras, Prajnaparamita sutra, and so on. This is by far from a complete list. This is the Ashoka Vadana, it's a biography of King Ashoka, more Prajnaparamita. The Baisajya Guru Vaidurya Prabharaja Sutra, which we're all familiar with, and even more gloriously, we have the Buddha Baladhana Pratiharya Vikurvana Nirdesha Sutra. I'm not even going. The Patna Dhammapada. So there's a Dhammapada version found from Patna. Dharma Skanda is an early Sarvasivadin Abhidharma work. Divya Vadana is another biography of King Ashoka. Ekadasa Mukha Hridaya. Hridaya? Ekotaragama. Yeah, I'm not quite sure what that is. Guna Prabhu, this is a Vinaya Sutra. This one's quite important. This is a Sanskrit text of the essential Vinaya commentary, which is used by all the Tibetans. So basically, that's the book which the Tibetans rely on as the Vinaya, even though it's an actual, it's a commentary. So you see, most of these are later texts, of course. Lalita Vistara is a Buddha biography.
Is that some of these later texts contain references to earlier texts?
They do, yeah. To varying degrees, yeah. The most interesting one in that regard is a thing called the Abhidharma Kosha Bhashya. Is it the Abhidharma Kosha Upayaka Nama Tika?
Wow.
Yeah. Which is a sub-commentary on the Abhidharma Kosha. And so that's the Abhidharma Kosha is a big Abhidharma book, which references a lot of suttas. And this book, the Abhidharma Kosha, takes those references and gives the full quotes. So it actually gives the full text of them. That's only found in Tibetan. So that's quite a valuable one. So here we have a couple of... I'll just give a couple of examples of the Sanskrit sutras. Ekotara Agama. I'm not sure this is the actual. This is the actual Ekotara Agama from Sanskrit. I do not. So the fact that they're in italics suggests it's reconstructed. So this is either partially or not even there in the manuscript and has been reconstructed.
I can only see one thing that's actually in the manuscript, which is the Bhiksha.
Yeah, so he's probably just got this second half of this one, and has inferred from that second half, the first half of it, based on the Pali, and then that's like got a negative and a positive side, and so he put that there, he's inferred that. So this gives you an idea of how difficult this work is. So I do not see even one Dhamma, okay? I do not see even one Dhamma that is so, that when it's well developed, is so gentle and so workable. That is to say, the mind, monks, when it's well developed, is soft and workable, pliable. Therefore, thus you should train that is the mind shall be made well developed. It shall be soft. It shall be workable. This, because, is how you should train yourselves. Okay, and then so on with some similar kinds of. Suttas is another one. I do not regard monks one Dhamma that is that when it is untamed, unguarded, unprotected, unrestrained, undeveloped, that leads to death, transgression and painful result. Such that is to say, the mind, because when it is untamed, unguarded, unprotected, unrestrained, undeveloped, leads to transgression and to painful results, and therefore, monks, you should train yourself thus, and so on and so forth. So we see very similar idioms that we find in the first section of the Anguttara Nikaya in the Pali. And so this is, you know, for those of you who've got some familiarity with these Pali suttas, this is give you an idea of how close they are. When the Dhamma Vinaya is badly expounded, then whatever is undertaken will lead to much papa, much wickedness and badness. Therefore, it is that is how it is when the Dhamma Vinaya is badly expounded. When the Dhamma Vinaya is well expounded, then what is undertaken will lead to much merit. That is how it is when the Dhamma Vinaya is well expounded. So these are obviously very simple sutras, and so on. I do not see one Dhamma by which Samanvagatang Satvana, by which beings are gathered together or something for the long wandering and faring on in samsara. By which the first point is not made known of suffering, and that is to say of the hindrance of ignorance. Okay, so I do not know one thing by which people are so bound up into samsara and the long wandering in samsara as much as ignorance. When avidj, hindered by ignorance, then beings keep on travelling through samsara, and there is no first point recognised of suffering. Etadeva sutrang ukva, and having spoken this sutra, then further this verse was pronounced, and then there's a verse which repeats that, and so on and so forth. So this is the Ekottara Agama. Here's the Mahaparinirvana Sutra. Okay, so this is this monumental piece of work done by Waldschmidt in the edition of it, the printed edition. He has the Sanskrit on one line, four columns: Sanskrit, Pali, Chinese, and Tibetan, and reconstructs the whole thing back from there. And so you can see here, he's got all these bits in brackets and things like that, which are all the bits that are missing from the text. Okay, and have been reconstructed by reference to the other versions. Thus have I heard at one occasion the Blessed One saying in Rajagaha on the Vulture's Peak Mountain. Now on that occasion, King Ajatasattu of Magadha, where Hedehiputta had enmity together with the Vrajis. Yes, Vrijibih, instrumental plural. He said this in his assembly. I, these Vajjis, which are so powerful and successful and secure and wealthy, and who are full of so many people and humans, I will destroy and smash them and bring them to disaster. Then King Ajatasattu Hiputra of Magadha said to Varshakara, the Brahmin minister, "Come, Varshakara, ehi tuang. So you see how similar, you recognize that from the Pali class? Exactly the same. "Come, Varshakara, yena." And again, exactly the same as Pali. Yeah, towards the Blessed One. Yena, towards. Yeah, yena bhagavaten upasankami, we have in the suttas all the time.
The fourth word in the exercise is stop me cold.
Yeah.
Yena towards.
Having approached and then in our words, from our respect, with our words to the Blessed One's feet, with your head, you should pay respects and ask if he is alpabadha, after he is healthy, and if he is well and at ease, and that he's strong and happy and not suffering, and that he's having a comfortable abiding. Okay, so go to him and do all these kind of nice things, and then say to him this: King Ajatasattu Vedehiputta of Magadha has enmity towards the Vajjis. He said this in the middle of the assembly: I will destroy and wipe out and smash and crush and annihilate those Vajjis who are so wealthy and powerful and successful and secure. And what does the Blessed One say? As Vasakara, that Blessed One, explains it, then you should remember it. Tad kasma deto. And then there's another question. Don't recognize this word. Okay, and then something. Avita tawadino. The Tathagatas, arahants, sammasambuddhas, speak what is avita ta, what is not otherwise. Okay? In other words, they always speak the truth. So you should listen to what he says. Evang deve. Yes, your highness, said Vashakara, the Brahmana minister, and so on and so forth, and then went off. And then it continues on from there. So I have a translation of this in my room, if anyone's interested. It's a translation done by Mark Allen. So that's a very nice reading.
So, translation of just this.
Just this sutta, the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, he did it as his honors thesis. Yeah. It was interesting when he first sent me an email a couple of years ago, and I wrote back to him his email and said, "Actually, I've got your honors thesis on my desk," and I was just reading it. He said, that's quite remarkable. It's just like one copy in the Sri Lankan monastery in Canberra, and I just borrowed it from there. Okay? So let's just give you an example. The agamas which we're reading in Chinese were translated from something that's very, very close to this. Okay? So this, of course, is from the Dirga agama. We're reading from the Madhyama agama. There's very little Madhyama material that's available in Sanskrit. There's quite a lot of Diga material, but as it happens, there's very little Madhyama material. But in terms of the language, the structures, the idioms, and so on, what the Chinese translators, such as Sangadeva, yeah, Gautama Sangadeva, pretty good, was working with something like that, AD, I think it's 430, something like that. And of course that same period, all the arguments were translated, but it's also when the bhikkhunis went to China. It's also quite interesting that so many things happened in a very short time. Anyway, they would have had something before them that linguistically was very similar to what we have here. Okay, Gulisani Sutta. Righty-ho. Now, Gulisani Sutta. That's if I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the bamboo grove. Squirrel's Sanctuary. Now, at that time, a bhikkhu called Gulisani, a forest dweller of lax behavior, had come on a visit to stay in the midst of the Sangha for some business or other. The Venerable Sariputta addressed the bhikkhus with pointed reference to the bhikkhu Gulisani, thus, okay, Gulisani a bhikkhu, so again, just to notice the idioms here, Gulisani nama bhikkhu, okay, so a bhikkhu whose name, nama, is Gulisani, okay, so this would be, nominative, yeah, quoting the name, you quote it in nominative, bhikkhu, he's an aranyako. Okay, so in the forest, padara samacharo. Okay, so samachara is conduct. Padara, what exactly does that mean? I'm not 100% sure, but it translated as lax behavior. We have pada samachara.
As in apumada, the opposite.
Could be. It doesn't say that, but it could be a corruption of that. Lax behavior.
Drunken behavior.
Padara. Maybe it just means that. I'm not familiar with it. According to the. Sorry? Oh, yeah. No, anyone, it's just someone who's living in the forest, according to the Chinese version, the Majjhima Agama version adds that Gulisani was arrogant, rash and noisy with a mind like a monkey. Okay, so a little bit more vivid there. Okay, Sariputta said, friends, Avuso. Okay, so the addressing the monks is Avuso. When a forest-dwelling bhikkhu comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should be respectful and deferential towards his companions in the holy life. So companions in the holy life, sabrahamachari. Okay? So this is the term. Sagaravena, together with respect. Sapatisen, deferential. Okay? Disrespectful. Just means, it's just the same thing. It means, deferring to.
What's
the which?
Pena.
This is a teachings guy. We're going to have some kind of tantric initiation before we go. Tena is typically, which means.
Not always.
Thank you. Typically, an instrumental singular on masculine A is ena, ending instrumental, meaning by, with, or through. Yeah. So this in this case it means by a monk. So aranyakena, bhikkhuna. Bhikkhuna here is also instrumental singular, and that agrees with aranyakena. Okay, aranyakena. Bhikkhuna, and this now is an adjective that's qualifying this, and this also is an adjective qualifying that. So, by a monk, so the by is the instrumental part, by a forest monk, forest bhikkhu, who is dwelling in the midst of the Sangha. Okay. Right. He should, if he is disrespectful and undeferential towards his companions in the holy life, there will be those who would say of him, what has this venerable forester gained by his dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he's disrespectful and undeferential towards his companions in the holy life? Kimpani masa na esmato aranikasa. Okay. Since there would be those who would say this of him, a forest dwelling bhikkhu has come to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha should be respectful and deferential towards his companions in the holy life.
We also kind of get this being a monk or nun as well. People think, oh, that person's a monk or nun, why are they angry?
Yeah.
Or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of left projection on people. Yeah. So always good to.
Projection also about forest monks.
Yeah, well.
Elevated behaviour expected from forest monks.
Yeah, as Nyan said once, like you went to the dentist, and the dentist said, well, you're a forest monk, you don't need an anaesthetic. He said, yes, I do. Yeah, well,
for a forest monk only, he says no, also for a city monk, so he sort of pulls the rug off this.
I was trying to maintain the suspense there, guy. You've given away the ending, but anyway.
Well.
Spoiler alert. Okay, anyway.
But it's also interesting because this is what does happen, is that a lot of, some people meditate, right?
Mm.
Do a lot of meditation,
yeah.
But then they come into a situation where they're with people and they just can't hack it. They're just completely,
yeah.
You know, all over the shop and completely angry or whatever, and
it gives
meditation a bad name.
Yeah.
Because people think, what's this?
Yeah.
This guy, or what's this?
Yeah. World yeah. Yeah. No. Exactly. And I saw that in Malaysia, for example, there was one monk who used to come to near where I was staying, and he was a very nice guy and that was living in the forest, but basically he just didn't know anything, you know, he was really a bit clueless, really. And, he used to come in and so on, basically lived by himself and didn't have any teacher or teachings, and, you know, he just used to say all these things and he just wouldn't know answers to questions or just say all these kind of odd things and so on, until one of the laymen there, who's a student of Bhante Hai, Bhante Dhamma Widow, gave him a copy of the Majjhima Nikaya, and said, Bhante, maybe a good idea to kind of have a bit of a read of this and stuff, and so... You know, and he sort of went off and read it. And came, oh, that's really good. Yeah, thanks. That's really useful. Yeah. So yeah, it can happen. Okay, next one. When a forest dwelling bhikkhu comes to the sangha and is living in the sangha, he should be skilled in good behaviour regarding seats. Goki. Asana kusalena. Skill. Literally, he should be skillful regarding seats. Asana is a seat. Kusalena. Thinking. Well, I'll just read the next bit.
Okay.
Thinking. Thus, I shall sit down in such a way that I do not encroach upon elder bhikkhus and do not deny new bhikkhus a seat. Okay. Okie dokie. So this is how he's skilled in seats. So remember, this is like the case if you're talking about somebody who's visiting a monastery. So if you arrive at a monastery, you don't want to go and sit on somebody else's seat, or you know, you don't want to think, oh well, you know, you're going to go and plonk yourself down on the senior monk's seat or something like that, or you know, and make people feel uncomfortable, or they don't want to say, oh, could you please move, venerable, or something like that. So you're sort of being sensitive regarding that. Okay.
Also, Vinaya rules regarding sitting down on a bench or a seat next to the senior monks, and also encroaching on other monks' space.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what he's referring
to. Yeah, it's also found in the Vinaya rules, yeah. Okay. And just regarding that one, just a little textual point according to Analio. Regarding the need to observe proper behaviour in regard to seats mentioned in both versions, Pali and Chinese, a difference can be noted between the Pali editions. So this is quite interesting because the Chinese and the Pali are the same, but within the Pali tradition there's a difference. Okay. The Burmese edition treats the need to know proper behaviour as a quality of its own, separate from proper behaviour in regard to seats. Okay, so they've separated out proper behaviour and skill around seats. Where in the Pali editions, both occur together as a single quality. The Pali commentary offers an explanation on proper behaviour in regard to seats, And once this explanation is completed, it turns to the implications of proper behaviour, a way of proceeding which suggests that the commentary considers proper behaviour as a quality on its own. From this it may seem as if Buddhaghosa commented on the reading now found only in the Burmese edition, which presents proper conduct as a separate quality. So, that's possible. Okay, so the proper quality is abhisamacharika, and this is basically a word that means, it basically means all of these kinds of politeness and etiquette matters of conduct among the monks, okay, as opposed to, so that aspect of vinaya as opposed to the kind of the ethical aspects of vinaya, but more like the politeness and those kinds of things. When we saw in the Gretel thing here, one of the texts of the Mahasanghika school is a Vinaya text actually called the Abhisamacharika Dhamma. Okay, so this is one of the Vinaya texts of the Mahasanghikas, is actually the text dealing with all of those things. They put that into a separate text. Okay, so then people will say, what has this venerable forest dweller gained by dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, since he is disrespectful? Since he does not even know what pertains to good behavior. Okay? Abhisamacharika. So, Seri Viharena, living in freedom. Seri, living in freedom, doing what he wants. Okay? Then he should behave properly. Next one. When a forest dwelling bhikkhu comes to the Sangha and is living in the Sangha, he should not enter the village too early or return late in the day. Okay? And if he does so, people will request, or will complain, saying, what has he learnt from living in the forest since he goes to the village too early and returns late in the day? So, of course, this refers to the alms round. He should leave after dawn and go into the village so you're not wandering around in the dark. And also not wandering around in the afternoon, the evening time, and so on. And in some ways you can see this dynamic is a little bit, in some ways it's the same as what we experience here, but in some ways it's also different. If you see in village culture, there's a lot of stuff going on in the village which is not behind closed doors as it is for us. For example, everyone's coming out and having a bath in Thailand, and like maybe in the early morning or in the evening. You know, you can see people down by the stream or by the water pump or something like that, having baths outside and things like that. So obviously that could, could be a bit awkward for a monk, and I've been in that situation where you're kind of walking past a house and there's a lady in the front of the house with just a very kind of thin sari or something like that having a bath. And so, these kinds of awkward situations, or again wandering around at night time and people could be like drinking and all of these kinds of things happening. So remember that in a village situation, everything's a lot more out there, it's much more in your face, whereas for us everything tends to be behind closed doors, unless you go to King's Cross or something, but most of it, we're much more private. So this is one of the reasons why, for this rule. Okay. When a forest-dwelling bhikkhu comes to the Sangha, is living in the Sangha, he should not go before the meal or after the meal to visit families. If he goes before the meal or after the meal to visit families, there will be those who say of him, surely this venerable forest-dweller, while dwelling alone in the forest, doing as he likes, must be used to making untimely visits, since he behaves thus when he has come to the Sangha. Okay. So, this is... this is one of the rule pure bhatang pacha bhatang kulesu charitang apajaya. Okay, so this is one of the Vinaya rules, a Pachiti rule regarding going around visiting families and so on when you've been invited for a meal. Okay, so the idea is that one shouldn't be kind of wandering around from house to house just going visiting all your friends and things like that, and just hanging out and chatting and so on. If you need to go into the town for alms round, or again, if you have some other business and you go into town, you do that business, and then when you finished it, you come back, but you don't spend your time wandering around, popping over to Paddy's for a cup of coffee, and then when I finish that, I'll just pop down to Elle's and have a bit of a chat, and then I'll go around the corner to Pat and James's and see if I can get another coffee from them, and then come back to the monastery late in the evening. So this is the kind of conduct that they're talking about.
Okay.
Hmm.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Does that have to be done during lunchtime or?
No.
Is there a lab?
Yeah. So this is just talking about like making kind of social visits and stuff like that. Not if you have a reason. Yeah. Okay. And this, I think this is one of the rules that's relaxed in the Katina period, is that right? This is one of the Katina privilege rules. We talked about the other day about the three robes rule and things like that. And there's some various things that are the Katina privileges which are relaxed during the Katina season. This is one of them. And so you can break this rule. The reason for that being that it was in a special allowance to give you a chance to seek robe cloth if you needed it. Okay? And so then if it was necessary, because in those days it was difficult to get cloth, so the monks might have had to go around. So you might, say, know a few people in the village, and you might pop around to their houses and just say, oh, listen, I'm getting a new robe, and I wondered if you'd be able to help me, or something like that, and if they've offered invitation. And each one might be able to give you a small piece of cloth, yeah? And so you might not be able to get the whole cloth from one person, but you might have to spend quite a bit of time to actually get enough cloth to be able to sew yourself a robe. So because of that difficulty, then this rule was relaxed in the Katina period. Okay. When a Pomeroy monk comes to the Sangha and is living in Sangha, he should not be haughty and personally vain. Anuddhatena. Puffed up. Proud, arrogant,
pompous,
yeah. Atma-pap. And personally vain. Okay? And if he is in that way, people will say of him, surely, this venerable one, and so on. So that seems pretty straightforward. When the bhikkhu comes to the Sangha, he should not be rough-tongued and loose-spoken. Okay? Mukharena bhavitava avikirna vajena, loose spoken, not just babbling along and so on. Next one, he should be easy to correct and should associate with good friends. Okay, so subhajena. Okay, so this is well, this is actually from vacha, as in the Metta Sutta, Suvacho. So this is unusual. Normally they don't do that. Normally it's spelled like that, Suvacena. It's probably more standard spelling. And so it literally is well speech. And so sometimes translated, I think in the when we do the Metta Sutta, we translate it as how do we translate it? Gentle in speech. Yeah.
Oh, it's not the one that's actually easy.
That's what it means. It means easy to speak to, yeah, but it's translated as gentle in speech, which is actually a mistranslation, yeah. It actually means easy to admonish. And you should be a good friend. Okay? With good friends.
And the definition of a good friend?
Is?
One who teaches you the eightfold path.
Right.
And points out your faults.
Right. So not hanging around with a group of 6 months?
Not hanging out in the office?
Not hanging out in the
office? After lunch, for lunch,
don't do that? Doesn't actually say that.
Yeah.
No. Maybe you could hang out in the office if you have good friends then.
Yeah.
Hanging out good friends doesn't mean people you like to socialise with. Okay. A. Forest runner Bhikkhu should guard the doors of his sense faculties. Indriye sugutta dwarena bhavitabhang. Okay, so indriya here means sense faculties, and gutta is guard, as in, oh my god. Not really. I was tricking you on that one. Dwara is door. Okay, so these are both Indo-European roots. Gutta is related to guard. Dwara is related to door. Guard the doors of his senses. So it's people always say the bhikkhunis have so many more rules than the bhikkhus, but hey, there's nothing about bhikkhunis having to do any of these things. They can just do what they like. Guarding the doors of the senses.
Yeah.
Well, the way it's always described in the suttas is not grasping at the signs and features. Okay, so that means not taking up or getting obsessed about those aspects of sense experience which are provoking unwholesome reactions or responses. Okay, so whatever that unwholesome reaction or response is, whether it's aversion or lust or delusion or confusion or whatever, then there's maybe some aspect of that experience which is doing that. Okay, and so you should try to avoid that. Now, in some cases, there are certain things which are obviously more provocative of those things than others. Okay, so sometimes the way to deal with that is simply not go there, right? And so, you know, you don't go to a striptease show. Okay, I think I'm going to go to the striptease show and I'm going to be mindful. Okay, and guard my senses.
Like,
right?
Like contemplate. You have to smoke, but as long as you're mindful.
Contemplate the suba and so on. And so you then think, well, no, actually, that's something that probably should be avoided, actually. And whereas in other cases, then you just be retain that kind of sense. So it's a matter of like understanding and being mindful of how the sense impact is affecting your awareness or affecting your mind. And if it's involving it in these kinds of unwholesome states of mind, then you need to do something about it. Okay. One way you can do it is to just focus on some kind of, if for example, if you feel attraction or something, then you can focus on some unattractive aspect of it. So Ajahn Brahm's advice to the bhikkhus is just look for the pimples. Okay, so if you're with some girl and you're thinking, oh, she's very pretty and so on, and then just look for the pimples. You'll always find something. Yeah, and what's interesting so much is not so much the actual pimples or not, but that you're actually turning the mind in the other direction, and then you see that what the mind actually does is it seeks out the attractive aspects of a sight. So you know, if you see a woman or a man that you're attracted to, you actually tend to focus. The mind actually focuses on those aspects which are attractive and try to forget about or filter out those aspects that are unattractive. Okay, and then that's an active process. It's an energy which the mind is actually doing, and so by deliberately turning it the other way, you just switch that off. Okay, so it doesn't have to be any kind of great thing. Right? It's not a matter of, you know, any kind of particularly advanced practice or anything, but it's just a matter of turning it the other way, and then you notice actually that other side is just as true.
What about smelling the roses? That sounds very, that's okay.
There's a sutra in the Samyutta Nikaya where this monk was plunged into the forest pool for a bath and then came up and sniffed the beautiful lotuses that were growing in the pool, and the deva that was staying nearby said, "Go, monk, you're a thief of scent. You're a thief of scent. You should guard your sense faculties."
You see, even that is wrong. What's the best part after that?
What's the best part?
And then he says, "Oh, thank you. You were right. Please, let me know if that falls in the future." And she says, "I'm not your wife." No, I'm not your slave, I think. Work it up yourself.
I always smell the roses as I walk past somebody's garden, so I mustn't. Is that right?
I'm just telling
just
you.
Look at the thorns on the roses.
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Smell the roses, but also look at the thorns.
No, look at the thorns and smell the manure at the bottom.
Contact
that path. You're directing your perception only to your attention only to the beautiful aspects.
That's right.
So
that's actually, you know, a very classic example, isn't it? The
yes.
rose or the lotus, you know. The flower is the beautiful thing. That's what we put our attention on. We want to watch the flower, we want to look at the flower, and that, of course, there's many other aspects of the plant that are not beautiful, but just the perception always shifts onto that thing.
Like the lotus has to grow from the mud, eh?
Yeah.
So imagine Charlie telling the monk he can get prison from his girlfriend from America.
Uh-huh. And how did that story go?
Go.
Was that explained?
Oh, yeah,
how
did
it take so long? I said,
yeah. Okie dokie, moving right along.
You can have that one at drinks.
Yeah, drinks
time.
Yeah, okay. So, some forest monks should be moderate in eating. Where are we? Moderate in eating. Bhojane matanyuna. Okay? He should be, with regards to food or eating, mata means measure or the amount. Anyu is knowing. Okay? So, he should know the right amount in food, quite literally. Okay? Then a forest-dwelling monk should be devoted to Jaggeriya.
She's coming back tomorrow.
And if he's not, then people say Jaggeriya, wakefulness. Okay? So, should be devoted to wakefulness. They should be of roused-up energy. Aradhavirya. Dania.
Yeah. I'm going to the thing. Would it be enough to notice where the mind tends to pay attention to? Because when I tried deliberately pointing my attention to the negative, I noticed that it went into this like negative fault finding, then it became very negative when I purposely started directing things to the negative. So would it be enough? Would it still work if we just notice where the mind tends towards, and then that would eliminate it? Would
That's very useful, but it's not going to work in every context. Okay, so the main that should be the kind of the basic thing is just being mindful about it. Okay, so the thing of looking at the negative, you just do when you need to. Okay, and yes, you're right. It can kind of, because we have ignorance and the mind is confused, yeah, then looking at the negative can spill over to an averse mind state. Okay, it's not the same thing, and it doesn't have to, but it tends to because we have confusion. So if you notice that happening, then you've got to try to clarify that in your mind, and you can of course then counteract that by developing metta, which will tend to keep a positive emotional state. But on the other hand, it's also not an unusual or particularly problematic thing to happen from time to time or as a phase in meditation. So the forest monks in Thailand say that it's quite common for people, if they're doing a lot of, say, body contemplation and things like that, they go through a period where you're like completely just disgusted with your body. You don't want to eat, you don't want to do anything, and you just go through this complete aversion to everything. And I mean, that's not a balanced state in itself, but it's a phase that you go through. So it's, you know, sometimes these things are not, in themselves, are not problematic. It just sort of happens for a while and then it goes away. So this is what you have to investigate. Yeah? It's just the process of coming into balance. Yeah? But you go through that. Okay, so the opposite of roused up energy is kusita, is lazy. Okay? Forest monk should be of established mindfulness. And as I've said so many times, this word, upacitta sati, okay, so satina is the instrumental form. Now, this is upacitta sati. If we bonk that off the beginning and link it onto the
front.
We have Sati Upatha, but then the U disappears. Sati Pitta, and this is a past participle. If we turn it from a past participle into a noun, we get. No, we don't get that. Na. I should copy an A from somewhere. Satipatthana. Okay? So when it says a monk has an established mindfulness, it's simply a grammatical variation or a grammatical function of saying that he has satipatthana or does satipatthana. It's the same word. Okay? Yeah. And going back one step. Okay, if a bhikkhu has confused mindfulness. Confused mindfulness, murta sati. Okay, so the opposite of upatthita sati is murta, confused mindfulness. Okay, then a bhikkhu should have samadhi. He should, okay, so he should be concentrated, have samadhi. If he's asamahito, if he's not concentrated, then they would complain about him. He should be endowed with wisdom, panyavata. If he's dupanyo, if he's stupid, they'll whinge about him. And he should be abhidhamme abhivinaye yogo karaniyo. He should do. This is kar, future passive participle, to be done, from the root kar. Yeah? He should do yoga. So he should practice yoga, but yoga in Pali always means something like. Should make an effort or be strive to or devoted to. Yeah, it's the same root as we have here, as we translated devoted to, anuyutta. Anuyutta. It's the same root. Just let me finish this bit, and then the Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya is obviously a bit of a controversial phrase. It's, of course, the Abhidhamma Pitaka that we have, it was composed long after the Buddha died, and we have occasional mentions in the suttas to the Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya. Obviously there's no text called Abhivinaya, and so this pair of things could not refer to an actual existing kind of body of text as such. It must refer in some way to an understanding of Dhamma and Vinaya, Abhi having prefix having the implication of higher, or also it's like something that's a slightly abstractive meaning, so like about the Dhamma. And that's also implied here, because the question here is if there are those who ask a forest-dwelling bhikkhu a question about the higher Dhamma and higher Vinaya. Okay? And so this is suggesting that the Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya is about being able to answer questions about the Dhamma. Okay? So this is what it means. It's something like a discussion about the Dhamma. And so this is also, it's referred to as the Abhidhamma Katha. It's like discussion about the Abhidhamma. So this is where the Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya would have started out. Is basically the Buddha would give a teaching, the monks would go off and they'd say, you know, what was the Buddha talking about? And say, I didn't understand that bit. And they say, well, no, actually that bit was like this, and we should understand that bit from that sutra. And there's a discussion about that. And that's where the Abhidhamma started from. Now, the Abhidhamma, of course, eventually became what we call the Abhidhamma Pitaka. Abhivinaya is probably what we call Vinaya. Right? So what we have as the Vinaya text, largely, not completely, but largely, is a discussion about the Vinaya. So we've seen all of these kind of word analyses and examples and things, and this is what I think is probably Abhivinaya. Okay, Whereas, say, the Patimokkha rules and things like that would be just the Vinaya as such. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is it okay that you clarify that? For example, energy into what particular, what is meant by energy?
What is meant by energy?
Energy?
Could I be more, could I talk about what the Buddha means by energy? Okay, well, one thing is that energy is perhaps not, in English you might distinguish between energy and effort, as in energy is a quality which you just have, you've got, oh, I've got lots of energy now, whereas effort is what you try to do, yeah? And so maybe when we're talking about energy, it's more that latter meaning rather than simply a thing which you have, yeah? It's actually putting forth effort. So energy, viryena dukkhamacchayati, by means of energy, instrumental singular, that one crosses over suffering. So this is very fundamental to the Buddha's teachings, is that basically nothing good happens without striving and without putting forth effort. And he was adamantly opposed to all the people who thought, oh, things are just inevitable or they're just going to happen by destiny and so on, and said you have to make it happen. So any times you see people saying, oh, this is inevitable, or this is going to happen anyway or whatever, then this isn't what the Buddha was saying. You have to always make an effort to try to do things. But of course, the point about the effort is it has to be balanced. And sometimes the right effort is to just watch over things, okay? But that's not watching over from a sense of just not caring about it or being indifferent to it, but watching over if everything's going okay, then there's no need to step in and do anything. But then the energy is, the wisdom recognizes, the mindfulness catches up and realizes what's going on. Wisdom understands what the situation is and knows what should be done about it, and energy actually gets up from its seat and does it. Yeah.
That energy would cover if, say, you're sitting for a long time and then it's healthy to get up and do walking meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So to get up and do it takes a bit of energy.
Absolutely.
That's
energy.
Yeah.
Getting out of bed takes energy, yeah. Breathing in and breathing out, yeah. Sometimes you think, I just can't be bothered. Yeah.
Didn't your dad talk about that?
Yeah, this is kind of moment of, this horrible moment of actually deciding to get out of bed in the morning. You have to sort of overcome that every day. It only lasts a few seconds, but it's very terrible when it happens.
You can actually dream.
What?
Then when you anything, and you wake up again, you know, and you might even dream that you've got dressed.
Uh-huh.
And you wake up and you see, my God, I'm still in my pajamas.
Wow, I haven't had that kind of...
No, that's true. I believe you. Okay? So, next one. Those bhikkhus should make an effort, yoga karaniya, regarding those peaceful liberations that transcend or go beyond form and are formless.
Jhanas.
Formless attainments. Okay? So, again, just to notice the idiom, we haven't mentioned jhanas. But here, a bit earlier, we've had the bhikkhu should be samahidana. Okay, and so this is obviously a sequence, and this is quite a straightforward sequence. The basic things of guarding your senses, being moderate in eating, devoted to wakefulness, rouse up energy, establish mindfulness, be in samadhi, and have wisdom. Now that sequence corresponds exactly to what we call the gradual training, which we met in many suttas. And so that's a pretty straightforward sequence. In Samadhi, that doesn't mention jhana, but obviously in context, that's what it means, as usual. But then the rest of them, it doesn't quite fit the sequence. Why is knowing Abhidhamma, Abhivinaya in there? Perhaps you might want to put the formless attainments after Samadhi and before wisdom, but it seems like that's a block up there, and then these are some other things put in here. So it's a little bit random in terms of the order. Similarly, the next one is also a little bit random in the order, because now it says one should make an effort regarding Uttari Manusa Dhamma. Which is jhanas, formless attainments, realizations, and psychic powers is the Uttari Manusa Dhammas. Dhamme is locative singular, should make an effort regarding, or about, but we would just translate it more straightforwardly in English as for, or make an effort, how does we translate it, make an effort to, apply himself to.
Same sequence as in the Chinese?
I think so. Do you comment on the different sequence? I think it's the same, yeah.
Locative is a noun, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, a substantive.
Dhamme.
Why dhamme?
It's irregular.
No, it's not irregular. It's a normal locative inflection.
Yeah, it's
all
the same until the end.
Early version, but not found in the Chinese parallel.
Where are we now?
Down at bottom.
Set low paragraph. Aspects of conduct.
Found in the Pali, not in the Chinese, not to visit families before and after the meal, to be easy to speak to and to cultivate good friends, be devoted, but to be concentrated and also to be wise. Also, they're not found in the Chinese.
And then set the paragraph above the last sentence.
Yeah, it has the same, the ones that are the same. Visiting might be respectful, behave appropriately in regard to seats, not enter the village too early or return too late, not to be arrogant or agitated, not to engage in loose talk, to keep the senses restrained, no moderation with food, be energetic, mindful, apply oneself to the higher doctrine of Vinaya, to be knowledgeable about the immaterial attainments, and to be knowledgeable about realization. Okie dokie. Now,
arrogant or agitated wasn't in it.
Arrogant or agitated, and Uddhata is...
We had arrogant.
No, that was the word that Bhikkhu Bodhi translated as like it's puffed up. What do you translate it as? Haughty, I think.
And looking well or vain, that's the word. But not agitated.
Not much about the sequence. Okay, so a few different ones. And interesting, this one about having samadhi and being wise is not in the Chinese. But as always, you see, we're different in the list, but that's obviously not the case, even though the Chinese doesn't mention being devoted to wakefulness and cultivating good friends. It obviously doesn't mean that they didn't think that you should do those things, because they're mentioned in dozens of other suttas, but it's just that it happens to not have found its way into this particular one. To admonish you when you need to be admonished. Yeah. To encourage you when you need to be encouraged. Yeah. Teach you when you need to be taught. Support you when you need support. Tell you to get your act together when you need to get your act together. Yeah. Be honest, in times when you need that, and to stick by you when you need that support. So these are all the qualities of a good friend.
What about Max that was living alone in the Buddhist time? Did he
Well, this was taught in the simile of the elephant and the pussycat. Okay. So the big bull elephant went down into the rushing stream and stood in the rushing stream and pulled up the water and had a good bath and splashed around and had a great time in the rushing stream. And on the side of the stream was a little pussycat. And the little pussycat thought, wow, why don't I wade into the stream, stand in the middle firmly upon my 4 feet and then have a good bath and enjoy myself. So he jumps into the water and gets swept off to his own destruction. In the same way, Marx. Here a monk sees a great disciple going off and living in the forest and doing his meditation and so on, and they think, why don't I do that? And they go off and then their mind's overwhelmed with wholesome dhamma. Yeah? So basically, and the standard often is if you've got decent meditation and have samadhi, then you can make good use of your time. Otherwise, can be not very productive.
A little bit earlier, one of those paragraphs was saying that the culture in at that time, something about talking, you don't tell a person straight to their face that they've done wrong, but you talk around it.
Yeah.
It was just an interesting paragraph.
Yes, this is just making a point about when in the sutta, then Sariputta doesn't directly criticize Angulisani, but and then another comments, this corresponds to a typical device for voicing criticism used throughout Asia, which by not directly addressing the person avoids embarrassing him or her, though all who are present, including the culprit, do know quite well who is meant.
We had this thing on the Wednesday night talks for Nigel Brown, it's admonishing.
Yeah.
We all get around together afterwards and work out, try and work out who it is.
Work out who it was, yeah.
Is he talking about me? Is he talking about him?
It's a worrisome way because you think it must be you.
Yeah.
It's
always
about you because you are the center of the universe.
Yeah, it's always about you, yeah. Yeah, I mean, sometimes it can be good, but it depends on the particular thing, you know. I mean, and especially when it's used like this. I mean, it's obviously used as an occasion for a very general teaching. So I said, well, okay, let's bring everybody into this. Yeah, so we're not making just one person's thing. In other cases, then you might have to just admonish someone individually. Okie dokie. So we've had the superhuman dhammas. Of course. Yeah, transcend is atikamma. Okay, and this is from the root kam, meaning to go, which is related to the English word kam. Okay. And this is a form meaning having gone. Okay, and the ati bit means beyond. So ati means beyond or over. So having gone over, having gone beyond. Okay.
And then what's rupa?
Rupe, having gone beyond forms, and it is formless, the formlessness. Okay.
We feel free to, you know, tell me when they decide
to
carry on.
I would never admonish you in that way, Dania. But there are certain people around the place who ask excessive numbers of questions and waste everybody's time. No, only kidding. Please. Your questions are very delightful and we encourage that, so please.
Not to delight in company, in order to have good meditation. But then on the other hand, in order to be secluded, you already have to have good meditation. Maybe could you clarify that little situation? So for example, in order to be alone, you have to be strong, but in order to be strong, you have to be alone.
Yeah, you just have to bootstrap it, that's all.
Sorry?
You just have to bootstrap it, that's all.
That's an army thing, isn't it?
No, that's a
you have to lift yourself up by your own bootstraps.
Yeah. But but when we meditate together, it's really, really good. And we don't talk. Never.
Talk all the time, right?
No, we don't. We're good meditation buddies.
Okay, so that's it, Danny. You know, we know the difference between hanging out with somebody because you just want to waste time and distract yourself, and then actually doing something that's meaningful, either into sitting meditation with somebody or doing something productive or talking about Dhamma or, you know, something like that. So whatever's conducive and helpful and things like that. So you just have to know that for yourself. But I mean, as a general rule in terms of practice, is that you know, it's for most people, as a very very common, very very vague generalization, that it's necessary and more useful, especially in the early years of practice when you're in the monastery, to spend more time relatively doing things like learning suttas, learning vinaya, learning your duties, and so on. And then as time goes on and you master those things and you have some confidence, you understand the Dhamma and so on and so forth, and gradually purifying your mind and establishing it on those wholesome basic Dhammas that we've met in here, discussing the Abhidhamma, Abhivinaya, sense restraint, and becoming more and more established on those things, the mind becomes more peaceful and more straightforward and more okay, and then the meditation will be more profitable and easier and smoother. And so this is why typically, you know, you have in the Sangha that period of like 5 years of dependence where you're supposed to do all those things and you're supposed to learn the Dhamma and learn the right conduct and learn all these things. And of course you're doing meditation during that period, but that's not the only thing. And then at the end of that 5 year period, then if you want to, then you're encouraged to go into seclusion and just meditate all day if you want to do that. Yeah. So that's just like a generalization. Okay. So, superhuman dhammas or not superhuman dhammas, what does it really mean?
Beyond the human dhammas.
Beyond the human dhammas, to be dissolved. Uttari or uttarin manusa dhamma. Okay.
Superhuman.
That means beyond the human dhammas. Okay. Beyond the human dhammas, meaning basically meaning more advanced than the manusa dhamma, and the manusa dhamma is usually the 10 pathways of wholesome action. Okay, so it means things which are beyond that, i.e. states of samadhi and psychic powers and things like that. Okay, so it's like the 10, like the ordinary good conduct, keeping precepts and things like that, they are the kinds of dhammas which are appropriate for the human realm. And if you do those things, then you get reborn into the human realm because of that. Yeah? Or you maybe go to the Devaloka and so on, but at minimum you get to be reborn in the human realm. But Uttaring Manusa Dhamma is dhammas that lead to a higher state than that. So, for example, you do jhanas, you get reborn in the Brahma realm. So this is why it's the Uttaring Manusa Dhamma. Or you don't get reborn at all, of course. Yes?
I think people believe that
Yeah, no, it's defined in the Vinaya. Basically, the definition is jhanas and different states of samadhi, psychic abilities, and the stages of enlightenment. So those, they're basically what it comes down to, yeah? Now, then the final paragraph. When this was said, the Venerable Mahamoggallana asked the Venerable Sariputta, friend Sariputta, should these things be undertaken and practiced? Undertaken, samadaya, and practiced, vatidabha. Only by a forest-dwelling bhikkhu, aranyike neva, okay, by a forest-dwelling bhikkhu only, eva, okay, or udahu, or gamantavir. Harina be, or also, or even be, by one dwelling in a village. Dhammanda. Yes, this interesting little phrase et here, Garmanta, you have this Garmantara is in the various Vini rules and things, and Garmantara is a bit controversial whether it means, Antara means between, so it's either between the houses, i.e. in the village, or it means between the villages, and so that's a little bit of a controversial thing, but this is not Garmantara, it's Garmanta, and Anta means end or edge, so you're living on the edge of a village. Okay, so it seems to be the implication that the even the village temples would be on the edge of the village rather than in the middle of it.
Wouldn't the objective be Gamma? Since it's Gamma,
it would be an object. If yes, the accusative form is Gamang. If you were saying go to the village,
or in the village,
in the village is locative. It would be Gamer.
Yeah? So it's not one of them.
It's certainly not one of them. Okay, and the answer by Venerable, Puts, that's Moggallana's question, and Puts' answer, friend Moggallana. I should just comment, we translate this word avuso as friend. Actually, the word for friend is mitta, which we met up above with the good friend or spiritual friend. Avuso doesn't really mean friend at all, and it's from the root Ayu, meaning old or age, okay? So it literally almost means venerable. It's actually the same root as the word ayasma. Those two words have the same root, and we translated that as venerable. But in terms of idiomatic usage, avuso is a little bit more familiar, and so it's conventionally become translated as friend in English, which is perhaps not the best rendering, but by a monk. Friend Moggallana, these things should be undertaken and practiced even by a forest-dwelling bhikkhu. How much more, then, by one who dwells near a village? Okay? Dwells near a village, Garmanta, as Bhikkhu Bodhi translated, Garmanta lives near a village, on the edge of a village. Pageva, and here is the idiom here, even more so, Pageva. Okay, meaning even more so. So, for example, in the simile of the raft, the Buddha said you should abandon even what is Dhamma, it should be abandoned. Pageva adhamma, still more so what is not Dhamma. Okay? So you should let go of Dhamma, even more so. Pageva, what is not Dhamma.
What was that? You should let go of Dhamma? What was that in?
The simile of the raft.
You should attach to the Dhamma.
Well, I don't know about attach, but let go sounds a little dangerous.
Don't
well,
you go once you get to the other side.
Yeah, simile of the raft, remember?
Oh, yeah, after you've used it.
Yeah, then you let go of it. Yeah.
It
don't let go of it midstream. Yeah? This is the.
Well, that's what I'm going to say.
Yeah, once you're on the far shore, then never mind.
Isn't that the case that it's the anagami who's still attached to the Dhamma? That's why he doesn't become
an
anagami.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Could be.
Dhamma
Nandita, Dhamma
Raga.
Yeah.
So I think kind of inside that the village monks should be practicing all this even more so.
Yeah.
But do you think that's mainly referring to the protocol stuff? Because I don't think they'd all be practicing things that refer mainly to people living in groups and community and so on, and interacting with families.
Yeah, it might certainly be more acutely relevant. Yeah, and you can actually, if you're living in the forest monasteries, you can basically sometimes you don't have to learn all that stuff. It doesn't come up. Yeah, and so sometimes you need more. That's why I think what says Pageva is sometimes you need actually much more effort if you're living in the village. You know, say Lumpur Chorp said that. I mean, he's one of the great forest masters. He said, whenever I would go and stay in the village, I noticed that my mind would go down and deteriorate, and that's why I had to go and live in the forest, you know. So, yeah.
You mentioned that the village here is not actually a village, but on the edge of the village.
Mm.
So Buddha didn't recommend monks to live in the village. And what is meant by at the edge of the village? Is that really more countryside where there's no
hard to say exactly. It might be something like what we're doing here. I mean, we are literally in terms of the legal situation, we are exactly on the edge of a village. You know, we are exactly 3 kilometers from the post office, and this is a defined edge of Bundanoon village, is right where we're at. So this monastery could be regarded as on the edge of a village. Yeah? But obviously it's a forest monastery. So it could, you know, it's difficult to generalize too much about that, but obviously the implication is that it's, you know, it's closer to the village and it's more involved with what's going on there.
So the Buddha didn't recommend, there weren't any monks living in the village in Buddha's time, yes?
Hard to say. I mean, I think there would have been, but obviously he, you know, what you do find in the suttas again and again and again, when it talks about meditation, it says, Aranyagato, gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, to an empty place. So there's nowhere where he encourages or praises going into the village. Yeah? But he, you know, when he spoke about it, as in this sutta, he's not criticizing anybody. He's not saying, Sariputta talking, not the Buddha, but he's not criticizing anybody or saying you shouldn't do this or that, but saying that wherever you stay, you should make sure your practice is
why would that have said that when he goes to the village his mind goes down? What is the fact that there is much distraction?
Yeah, just the distraction and stuff going on, yeah. Right. I find it interesting, Bhante, that the Brahma realm is spoken of in Buddhism, and I hear in the suttas that prior to the Buddha there was established belief in the Brahma realm, which suggests that prior to the Buddhism people had some damn good meditation in order to realize these other realms. I'm guessing that the Brahma realm has something to do with Brahmanism. Yes, indeed it does. I think that's true, don't have any doubt that people were meditating and doing all that kind of stuff, probably getting jhanas and all of these kinds of things. And you know, of course, you have the Buddha's teachers who are doing formless attainments and stuff like that. So, and in the Upanishads, it's also very suggestive of a kind of very meditative, contemplative kind of environment. Certain parts of the Upanishads. So, I think that's all true. In terms of the relationship between the Brahma realm and Brahmanism is complex, okay? It's not a simple thing. The way that the Brahma realm is spoken of in Buddhism is basically of a particular kind of heavenly realm, which is on the same scale, the same ladder, as the other kinds of heavenly realms. It's just a different kind, and this one happens to be produced through the practice of jhanas rather than through lesser forms of doing good, yeah? And born into that realm are beings, so kind of like individual persons, if you like, who get born as Brahmas for a period of time, stay there for an eon or a few, or up to 60,000 eons or something like that in the formless attainments, and then they come back down again. So this is how the Buddhist conception of that. Now, the within Brahmanism, they don't necessarily think of the Brahma realm in the same way. And in fact, over a period of time, and Brahmanism's evolved for thousands of years, so over that period there are many different conceptions of what Brahma means, and it's thought of and spoken of in many different ways. In the earliest times, in the Rig Veda, Brahma was a word which meant something like, they use, in anthropology, they use the word mana, which means the kind of taboo power or magic power, a bit like the force, right? So Brahma is like the force, the life force, the kind of the energy which lies behind magic, or the energy which makes things grow, and these kinds of things. And this is, Brahma was that kind of living energy. And it kind of evolved. One direction it took was to imagine Brahma as an anthropomorphic deity. So you have like myths and legends and so on which talk about Brahma as a deity who does various kinds of things, and he's depicted in images and so on and so forth. There was another sphere that it went down, or another line that went down, which they call the non-dual teachings, where Brahma was not a personalized deity, but was that. And this is where they say, Tad Tvangasi, thou art that. Yeah? And he is the cosmic consciousness, or he is the essence of being, or whatever. But some kind of depersonalized form of Brahman. Now, that depersonalized form of Brahman was first taught in the Upanishads shortly before the Buddha, And my feeling is that that was based on Samadhi experiences, is where they had this kind of idea. You basically immerse yourself in a kind of infinite consciousness, and then you take that to be the ultimate. So the difference, of course, between the Brahmanical systems and the Buddhist system is where the Buddhist system, the Brahma realms, are just another realm in the cosmology, albeit a very nice one to go to and have a bit of a holiday in. But for the Brahmins, obviously, it's the goal, it's the thing, it's what they're striving to do. Yeah, so that's the difference. The non-dual school, which is the school that said, thou art that, although it had roots in the Upanishads and people like Yajnavalkya and so on before the Buddha, it seems that it was not necessarily the kind of a particularly important or dominant line of interpretation of Brahmanical thinking for a long time after that. Okay, and so you've got many, many other kinds of teachings and so on in the Brahmanical school. And it was in the time of Shankara, I think, 7th, 8th century? Shankara, something like that? Was a Brahmanical philosopher, Hindu philosopher, and he was debating with the Mahayana Buddhists at the time in India. And he was the one who put the non-dualist philosophy, they call it Advaita Vedanta, firmly in the center of the map. So he was like the great hero of the Hindus, and he kind of synthesized the whole spectrum of Brahmanical and Indic teachings under one kind of umbrella, and with that non-dual teaching as the peak of it. So everything else was sublimated within that non-dual teaching, that everything in the end was just that. Yeah? And so since that time, since the time of Shankara, that's commonly been regarded as the kind of the highest philosophical teaching in Hinduism. Whereas, of course, it's not something which the people who follow Hinduism and the villagers would ever know anything about. They just go and worship gods and do sacrifices and ask them for favours and so on. But on the philosophical level, that's often usually regarded as the kind of the highest expression of Brahma. Okay. I maybe just should mention that I've mentioned this before in the classes, but it's sometimes said that the Buddhist scriptures, the Pali scriptures, don't mention or don't refer to these kinds of non-personal or cosmic interpretations of Brahmanism, and that they always refer to only a personal Brahma. And that therefore it can be taken that Buddhism and Vedanta are somehow teaching the same thing. But that interpretation is incorrect, because there are quite a few phrases and so on in the suttas that clearly refer to that kind of cosmic Brahman idea. The most obvious one being so atta so loko, the self is identical with the universe. Okay, and so this is clearly talking about the same kind of idea. It's that particular one's in it's in the I think the Alagadupama Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, so atta so loko, and that kind of expression is an idiomatic expression implying an emphatic identity. Yeah, it's not just saying the self is the world; it's saying, you know, the self is identical with the world in every respect. Yeah? So it's quite a strong thing. And even the phrase, you know, you have the phrase tad tvam asi, which is very famous from the Upanishads, is exactly the same as eso hamasmi. Is a very, very normal phrase in all the suttas, which I am that. And this is what you find in the Anattalakkhana Sutta and all of these kinds of things, sometimes in the negative form. Of course, when the Buddha was teaching, it was I am not that. But actually the word eso hamasmi, tad tvam asi, is exactly the same as the Brahmanical phrase. It's just grammatically slightly different, but you have eso hamasmi, and the Brahmanical phrase is usually said to be tad tvam asi, and if you break the words up, then you see they're exactly the same. It's just this is in second person, thou art that, and this is in first person, that eso is the same as yat. Ato is one that should not yat ta. Tatwangasi. And these are the different demonstrative pronouns we learned in the lesson last week. We have the ones beginning in tang and then the ones beginning in so. It's just a different form of the same thing. is so that twang you and I and asi am. Okay, again, just different forms of the verb, so exactly parallel phrases that we find. You've just come right at the right time. Evan. That's it.
Is Twang you or
Twang is you.
Ready? Handamayang dama owarakataya sadukrang dama se.